And welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Don't forget to check out Dr. Drew After Dark. You can find that over on YouTube and at drdrew.com. Also, the family of pods there. And support those that support the pods so we can keep this sail in the wind of the Corolla pirate ship. It is my privilege to welcome to the show today Kevin Folta. He is does his own podcast called Talking Biotech. You can follow him on his website, talkingbiotechpodcast.com, or on Twitter at Kevin, F-O-L-T-A. And amongst other things, we're going to get into his area of interest is photomorphogenesis in plants. Wouldn't that about summarize it? Like how plants know to go towards the sun.
Well, it's one of the things. It's actually.
I'm going to have you come right up.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Let me get up in there. Yeah, it's actually much more complex. It's a developmental program that happens, changes in gene expression that happen when plants see specific parts of the spectrum.
Of the light spectrum.
Of the
light. It's so funny. When I was studying biology back in undergraduate years, there's some sort of hormone that that sort of gets activated on one side of the plant that pulls the plant to that direction. And when I was back then, they announced that's how the plant goes towards the sun. And as everything in biology, once you find one thing, that's just you're just scratching the surface. There's always an underlying mechanism and a deeper mechanism, and then a genetic mechanism, and then a regulatory mechanism, and then an upstream regulatory system. I'm imagining that's what you're studying now.
Well, pretty much. Yeah. You know, it's actually funny you brought that up because some of the seminal discoveries were done by Fritz Wendt right at Caltech. Hmm. And I was there today. And it was really kind of cool to be there. And now we know the receptor that sees the photon of blue light that then leads to the reapportionment of the hormones that cause that bending. Super cool stuff. And we understand it to the molecule.
And you said there was a genetic mechanism within that, right?
Well, a number of genetic mechanisms from the sensors themselves all the way to the genes that are turned on.
So their genes turned on by the sensory experience of the blue light, and there's got to be a regulatory system in the DNA and the gene turn on and off, and then an RNA system that's regulated also, right?
That's right. I actually did my PhD thesis on the RNA part of that equation.
Oh, my God. It's so complicated. That's why I get crazy when people say things about biology and they just don't understand what they're talking about.
Yeah, but it's cool because you get it. And that's what I really like about this. You know, I've listened to you and Adam since Loveline days.
Oh, boy.
And I listen.
You're still okay.
And I listen
every
day.
You're still in the
sciences. And I turned out okay.
So far. We'll see.
But what's really cool about this is that, you know, I hear you talk about translation, you know, in the philosophy of science and hypothesis testing. And it really is healthy because so much of the media gets it wrong.
Oh, my God. It's how you know there's such a thing as fake news. There's actually something called the Gell-Mann effect. You heard about this?
Yes. Yeah.
Guy's a physicist. He noticed that every time he saw a story on physics, it was inaccurate or wrong. And he would forget about that. And every time he'd look at something complex like world history, world events, or diplomacy, he'd figure that was accurate. But of course, it's all inaccurate. If you're an expert in diplomacy, you would know that's also inaccurate and wrong.
Well, and that's what I've really dedicated a lot of time to. I'm not just a professor who's working as a university professor, teaching and doing research.
You're at?
University of Florida.
And you had your PhD in molecular biology at University of Illinois, Chicago.
That's right.
My dad went to medical school there. Postdoctoral at University of Wisconsin. And your biology degree originally in Northern Illinois.
That's right.
Go Huskies.
Yeah, go Huskies. Yeah. But
Adam and I spoke there a couple of times.
I know. I heard about that.
Crazy.
The place that invented barbed wire.
You heard us talking about it. And Cindy Crawford comes from the vicinity, right?
That's right. She was actually, when I was in school there, she was in like the weekly newspaper, you know, every week. But getting her start. But all of that idea of deciphering the science and getting it straight has really become a passion of mine.
Yes.
That I could just be doing my laboratory work that would keep me busy all the time. But I've fallen in love with the idea of trying to rectify the copious misinformation that's happening, particularly around genetics and particularly around food.
Right. So we're going to get into that. But I see the most grotesque sort of claims in nutrition and diet, because as Kate Shanahan says, it's just too complicated. We can't say anything about it as scientists. It's too complicated. There's a couple little things we can talk about and say something about, but making all these definitive claims, it's like, here's what I've noticed, is that people try to turn complex biology into simple narratives, like stories. And we do that as humans. I understand. Even you and I as scientists, we'll talk about, you know, electrons wanting to go to another energy level, or proteins wanting to fold in a certain way. of course, we're anthropomorphizing just for the sake of discourse. We don't really mean it. But out in the world, people really mean it. They make real narratives that are just so far from the truth that it's hard for me, because I always tell people the way I try to get it out in sort of bite-size reframing is to say biology is just a giant probability equation. It's just all these probabilities. And if you try to make a narrative out of probabilities, you're missing it entirely. Am I on to something?
Oh, you're exactly right. Yeah. And that's why when we do science and we design experiments, we reduce the number of variables to make it as simple as we can to understand a skeleton of the problem we're wishing to solve.
Right. It's never. And then you're trying to fit these models and graphs to what your data shows you.
That's right. And so when we go on these things about diet or about anything, we also have genetic overlays, you know, each one of us being genetically so different from each other.
So complicated.
Metabolism, microbiomes, mm-hmm. all the stuff that makes us different from each other. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about all these issues like health and diet, whatever, I know it works for me.
Yeah.
And people will say, well, you know, you shouldn't do that. That's crazy. How can you eat like – but I know what makes me feel decent, what keeps my weight controlled, and it doesn't work for anybody else.
Yeah.
But that's because of my screwy genetics and the genetic hand I was dealt.
I have the exact same phenomena with myself. Yeah. I've had to cut out carbs and sugars and stuff, mm-hmm. and that made a huge difference for me. Not for everybody, but at my age now, my genetics works.
No, I feel the same way. I when I eat carbs, I crash in the afternoon. I like a little protein in the morning and something decent for dinner, and that's it.
So the I think what we're sort of aiming towards or getting towards is all the misinformation about plants and foods, right? And the GMO thing is one of those things. Talk to me about that.
Well, really what we've been looking at is – and this is what drives me crazy. I work in a public institution – and I see all of these scientists who are doing beautiful work all around the world solving problems for people.
So that we can avoid famine, for instance.
Well, avoid famine, but at such a micro level, helping to make plants can fortify zinc or iron, vitamin A, solve problems with plants that can grow in adverse environments. All of these kinds of solutions that my colleagues are coming up with, and it's amazing stuff, and the journals are full of them. But the rubber doesn't hit the road. These innovations that we all did because we care about people, we care about our planet, are not getting to the people they're meant to serve. And that's why I try to get out and step into this discussion and at least illuminate the idea that this idea of genetic engineering of plants is not this evil, dark science that that we need to shun.
It's something we've been doing throughout human history.
Yes.
We just do it better now.
We do it with much more accuracy.
We used to do it by grafting plants together and things. Now we do it at the cellular level.
Oh, yeah. It used to be plant sex.
Yeah.
Where you're mixing – or even worse, you know, the first selections that people did when we were domesticating things like corn, you didn't have any idea that they were mating or crossing with pollen. You just know that those plants lived and those ones died.
Yeah.
So you save the ones that survived the next year, and we changed the genetics slowly over time. And now we have really, in my opinion, the best, safest, most abundant and diverse food supply in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be celebrating that. And unfortunately, food has become the enemy for so many people, especially technology around food. And it means that we're not able to get the technologies to the poorest people in the world, the food insecure, and so many good solutions that can help the environment.
Why? I don't get it. Is it that it's a lack of education?
No, I think the problem is not an education problem or an information problem. And this took me years to understand as a scientist.
Uh-huh.
You know, my first way of solving a problem here is to beat people over the head with more information and show the figures.
It's weird that we as scientists, that's what we do. But I think the average human needs persuasion, which is
that's
a different thing.
And I study persuasion.
Oh,
I'm a big fan of Aristotle.
And,
and so we and thinking about persuasion and argument and the things I learned as a debater, as someone who could discuss these things in that context, I started to apply those to talking about the science with the public.
Mm.
And really what the problem wasn't information. It wasn't education. The problem was communication.
Hmm.
And it's still a problem we suffer from today as farmers and scientists, ag industry. We're not connecting with people the right way. And so this is what I'm talking about tomorrow in Canada. This is what I go around the country talking about almost every week, is training scientists and training farmers, training people who are in agriculture to talk about food in a way that resonates. And we're trying to get people to change their tune so that the innovations can get to the people that need them.
And so how do we get people to stop with the paranoias and understand the science, how it works?
Yeah, I think the funny part is that it's not about understanding the science. I think it's about trusting the scientist. And so if we can show that we are a trusted entity, and we're, again, going back to rhetoric, not to convince somebody of a certain set of facts, but rather that to show our values, you know, what's important to us. And you were even talking about this last week. How do we change somebody's mind?
Mm-hmm.
And we change somebody's mind by showing them that, that we're sensitive to their concerns, that we have competence, that we don't have skin in the game in terms of some sort of selfish cause. We're in this for the right reasons. And I'm the guy in the grocery store who talks to the person who's shaking their head at the tomato, you know, and saying, I don't want this. It's covered in pesticides and it's a GMO. And I was like, well, let me tell you a little bit about that tomato.
Go ahead and do it.
And, well, no, but that's the basic idea.
But tell us, because I saw you write something. I saw something we were talking somewhere about how extraordinary is it the tomato's 85 cents or whatever it is.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I'm blown away by the cost of food. We have never paid less money as a function of our income for food than we do now. And we don't appreciate that. That's why we have food waste. This is why there's so many problems with people feeling like the technology is bad. We don't appreciate what we have and the abundance that we have. And I've been to places throughout the world, Uganda, I've been to China, I've been to some of the most poverty-stricken areas you've ever seen. And it gives me a very different look of every piece of food on my plate.
Mm. And what do we need to do to get the food there?
Well, to get food to folks in those areas, we have to enable them with technologies to be able to cultivate for themselves.
But there was all this fear that Monsanto was going to come in and whatever, and the seeds are somehow going to replace the natural or the products they're accustomed to. They have all these paranoias about it.
Oh, sure. But this is what's so heartbreaking is that when I was there, I went to the Kiwanda Agricultural Park, which is where scientists from Uganda and Kenya had constructed banana plants that could survive banana bacterial wilt. Mm. And it's actually called matoke there. It's a banana that's like a plantain, very starchy, but it's the basis of every diet. It's like the rice or potato.
Mm.
And people would have this banana, and if you don't have this, it's not dinner. That's what they would say.
Yeah.
But the banana plants are on small acreage, 2 to 5 acres, usually tended to by women. And the small acreage is sick with bacterial wilt from something called Xanthomonas. And the trees lose their vigor and die. And if your trees die, you don't eat. And my friend who's there says, you know, people turn to crime, people turn to other problems, or they don't eat, or they eat poorly. And so what we need to do is, well, back to Kiwanda Research Park, the scientists there have engineered the banana, the Ugandan banana, not Monsanto, not anybody else. The Ugandan scientists have engineered this with a gene from pepper that allows it to have resistance to Xanthomonas. Mm-hmm. And the trees are beautiful, but they're behind barbed wire. And it was hard for me to see what I saw and then stand in that grove of trees and see here's the perfect ones on this side where people can't have them.
Mm.
The problem is that the government is so afraid because the Europeans, because of the Americans, because of active American NGOs in Uganda saying, if you eat this, you will get cancer. If you eat this, you will have
– what?
You'll be turned homosexual.
Why are they doing that?
Because so many of these organizations have such a deep-seated hatred for the companies like the Monsantos and stuff, which doesn't exist anymore, by the way, for the corporate side of this, that they can't have that first domino fall. And the minute that genetic engineering helps people in an altruistic way, their game is over. And that's why this has been such a why there's so much of a campaign to distort the real information.
It seems inhuman. But the way you're describing it, it sounds like a conspiracy in the other direction.
It really is, unfortunately. I hate saying the word conspiracy, but what it is a very small number of people who have a very deep-seated fear and hatred of either food technology in general. You know, they want to return, you know, they don't like any herbicides or anything.
Why? What's their fear?
I think a lot of it is seated back in, it comes from very good and valid concerns from the 1900s of companies that didn't do the right thing and maybe led to disasters like, you know, Bhopal, India was Union Carbide, which was bought into this in the companies that eventually are selling seeds. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of understand that. You know, it's weird when they first started putting donuts in gas stations, you know, you're like, here's a guy pumping your gas with one hand, handing you a donut with another. It just was like this strange mixture of we're the company that's going to create the seed technology and we're also doing chemistry. Mm-hmm. And so people were always very suspicious and they were the first ones to roll this out. And when they did it in the 1990s, they didn't have good communication skills. They weren't paying attention to how this would resonate. And at the same time, the internet was born. And the internet was controlled essentially by folks who were able to malign the technology very effectively, and something we still see the residues of today.
But it still was effective in eradicating or resisting a lot of famine. We've had some huge – tell us about the benefits. Well, there have been some massive – I mean, but when I was in training, famines were guaranteed by the 2000s, guaranteed. And then we genetically engineered some resistant and drought-resistant strains of rice and things, and that was that.
Well, you know, the major ones that we're dealing with are corn, and the corn is the big one. Corn is mostly engineered to be insect-resistant. And that way, folks in places that don't have access to pesticides or chemical controls.
So people freak out about the idea that Roundup is in the corn.
Oh no! So let's break that down first. So let's talk about insect resistance. Mm-hmm. The insect resistance comes from a naturally occurring protein that comes from bacteria called it's called delta endotoxin, because that's what it is in the bacterium. The gene for this is taken from the bacterium and put into the plant, and it targets only a specific insect. So it'll either be moth larvae or maybe beetles, but it doesn't affect other insects, and it certainly doesn't affect us. Mm-hmm. And so instead of spraying a field with insecticide broad spectrum, like they have to do to non-genetically engineered corn, the genetically engineered corn protects itself, and only the things that feed on it are affected. So this is a really great strategy, and it's cut insecticide use on corn and cotton between 10 and 90%, depending upon where you are.
I remember we also had grave concerns about insecticides and herbicides choking off rivers and lakes and things like that back in the 80s.
Well, it's really changed because and people will say, well, there's more used all the time. Well, yes, there's more field being cultivated, but the persistence has gone down and also the toxicity. So we're looking at different classes of herbicides and insecticides that have less environmental impact using an equivalent amount.
How do you reassure people that start to get paranoid about this molecule being in their corn, whether it's an herbicide or a insecticide?
Yeah, that's really difficult because it's something that does have an effect on insects. And so people think, well, if it kills an insect, I must be targeted too.
Or it accumulates in my body.
Well, the way that I always discuss it is it's like how you wouldn't give your dog chocolate, mm-hmm. but you would eat chocolate.
Right.
And it's something that's toxic to one organism because it has a different metabolism and a different biology that doesn't affect you.
Right.
And so this is why that works.
Even if it accumulates.
It doesn't accumulate,
which
though.
It doesn't, but yeah, let's say it did.
But it's a protein that's broken down, and this is what's so cool about this. We know how it breaks down. We know what this molecule looks like. We know how it behaves. We know how the different herbicides and insecticides are metabolized by the body and how they leave the body. Their pharmacokinetics are well understood. And this is why you can measure it.
Yeah, and if there was any hint of anything in this litigious society, believe me, there would be lawsuits all over the place. If there is even a hint of something going wrong.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's even
– and it'd be an easy thing to prove because you know the molecule and you know you can measure it and that's it. If it's going up and some sort of problem is emerging, there's the association even. The courts don't wait for causation. They'll sue you on association.
Well, look how fast it happens around instances of food poisoning. Mm-hmm. That if you have a case of Listeria, they can chase this back to the assembly line that it was done on within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so it's an amazing thing. It's a testament to our excellent supply chains, which means getting the food from where it's made to where it's going. But it's also an excellent opportunity. But it's also a testament to the traceability and how well we understand where things come from.
I don't want to jump around too much, but as long as we're talking about people developing paranoias, and having backfire effects and not really fully understanding a topic. Vaccines go into that same category, it seems like.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And this has been another topic that I've had to work with personally over the years, because I live in the town with a very active vaccine opponent. Mm. And she's really vocal. She's on local radio and everything. And back in 2000 and maybe three or four, we used to have conversations, and I would say to her, you know, it's too bad that it's unethical to do the experiment, that we could maybe just vaccinate some of the kids and not the others, and let's see what happens. But that we couldn't do that. Well, here we
are. That's what's happening now.
Yeah. Yeah, we're in 2019, and those parents did the experiment.
Yeah.
And so now you did the experiment, and we found that, yes, the vaccine does provide protection. Mm-hmm. The unvaccinated are now vulnerable. And you see this especially, and Dr. Paul Offit has discussed this many times, but he's seen all kinds of things happening, like in the Amish communities, in places where you had pockets of people who weren't vaccinated, where one little ingress of that disease, that pathogen, leads to a chronic infection of that entire group.
Yeah, and there are parts of Southern California where you're visiting right now, particularly the Los Angeles area, where the vaccine penetrance, the vaccine rate is about equivalent to the southern Sudan. And so we are going to see some stuff here. And it's weird, again, back to the education about biology. And you're saying it's persuasion, but it's like we've forgotten we're biological. And because they haven't seen infectious diseases, we don't need sanitation. And you can let the homeless and the rats run wild. And now we're seeing rickettsial outbreaks. And soon we're going to see Yersinia outbreak. We've got a mosquito that's arrived here in Southern California that's going to create dengue here. And we're pretending it's not happening. And the same thing is true with the viral illnesses, that we could be protecting ourselves with vaccines.
Oh, sure. And especially in this day of rapid travel and easy access to travel, we're vectoring diseases everywhere.
Yeah.
And in Florida now, we have dengue. We have
chikungunya.
I always want to say chicken fingers or something.
Yeah.
Chikungunya. But we're seeing diseases that – and now with measles, which was, I can't say eradicated,
nearly,
but eliminated from the U.S. In the 2000. We're now seeing very strong
Wait to see it in adults. It's horrific in adults. Well,
I can imagine. I mean, I had a chicken pox breakout as an adult, and it was horrible. I can only imagine measles.
Measles is way worse. It's way worse. A lot of them end up in the ICU. They get encephalitis. They get pneumonias. They get all kinds of horrible stuff. Mm. Well, so you're giving a talk tomorrow?
Well, I'm actually speaking tomorrow
in Calgary?
Yeah, in Lethbridge. it's a small town in Alberta, a large town in Alberta. But we're speaking with farmers, mostly sugar beet farmers, because they're seeing pressure on their industry. Stop using certain chemicals. Stop using certain genetics. And yet this is what grows there, and this is what allows them to farm profitably with the least environmental impact. And the problem is the farmers aren't engaging, and they're not becoming part of the conversation. Yet they're the most trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to do is mobilize them, teach them how to use social media, teach them how to behave in social media, you know, how not just to go in as an authority and say, I'm an expert, listen to me, that's it. That's what they do.
How should they behave?
Well, what they have to do is talk about what's important to them. What are their values? Retreating to, and if we frame this in the Aristotle angle here, the ethos. You know, what is our credibility? What is our experience and our background? What's important to us? And, talk about, this is my family's farm. This is what my family eats. I'm not going to spray something that's going to endanger my family. And that's where it needs to come from. It can't be the way that scientists and farmers normally talk to people, which is, hey, I got it. Don't worry about it.
Isn't it crazy, though, that we can't have real intellectual discourse, which is where we actually just debate the facts?
Yeah. Well, but see, you and I can debate the facts all day. And that's the language you and I appreciate. And that's the language that, that's what makes scientists and farmers talk to each other very well. We love that.
It's how we solve problems. It's how we move the science forward.
But if you're a mother who's, sitting with her two children, facts don't matter. It's about the feeling.
Yeah.
And this is where, as a scientist, studying what I've studied, molecular biology, I never learned about cognitive psychology and how people think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to read the books by Kahneman and understand that there's, two parts of the brain, this reptile reactive brain and then this executive function that are completely separate. And the executive function doesn't – the reptile brain doesn't hear facts.
Mm-mm.
and that's where the decisions are being made. And yet, as scientists, we're appealing to this other part of the brain that's making more complex decisions, but the evolutionarily primed and very successful reptile brain is dictating those decisions.
I hate that. Have an original painting of yourself, your children, family, a special place, or a cherished pet at a price you can afford. From paintyourlife.com. That's right. It's a painting. It's done by hand by a world-class artist created from a favorite photo. It's very easy. I did it myself. It makes a perfect gift for birthday, anniversaries, Mother's Days. You choose the artist whose work you most admire and work them through the process until every detail is just the way you want it. And there's no risk. If you don't love the final project, your money is refunded. It's great for decor. It's a work of art. With Paint Your Life, you get your favorite memories transformed into a work of art that you will cherish forever. It's a special gift for someone you love or yourself. Right now is a limited offer. You can get 30% off your painting. That's right, 30% off and free shipping. And it's so easy. You just go to the website, you find the picture you want, and you put it up there and you work it through. It's really a fun process. To get the special offer, free shipping, 30% off, text the word Drew, D-R-E-W, to 484848. That's Drew to 484848. One more time, text Drew to 484848. Messaging and data rates may apply. Modern Fertility is the first comprehensive fertility hormone test for women that you can take at home. That's right. We're waiting these days to have kids. There's a lot to be done with our careers. One in six couples have trouble conceiving. And we have all the tools to prevent pregnancy, but we need more information to help us plan for the time when we want to become pregnant. Modern Fertility gives you customized reports to help you understand your fertility through your hormones. This is really important. You'll have a personal fertility team help you understand your results and make a game plan. You get access to the team of fertility nurses, a weekly webinar, and online community of women just like you. It's cost-effective. You get a custom report dashboard. Proactive fertility hormone tests aren't covered by insurance and can cost up to $1,500, but at just $159, Modern Fertility gives you access to the information you need, plus planning, how to deal with it. So whether you want kids now or far in the future, you can use your Modern Fertility results and resources to map things out in your own terms. It's important to plan. People don't plan for these things, and you've got to. We don't wait and see for anything else in our lives, and fertility should not be any different. All tests are conducted in a CLIA-certified lab, and Modern Fertility's team of physicians and clinical advisors lead some of the nation's top fertility clinics. I want you to visit Modern Fertility right now, /Drew, take their fertility quiz, and get $20 off the Modern Fertility test. That is modernfertility.com/Drew to take the fertility quiz and get that $20 off. Again, it is modernfertility.com/Drew. Saggy jawline, ladies and gentlemen, it's now over. Introducing Genucil jawline treatment with dual peptide and MDL technology. It's Chamonix's most advanced technology. It not only tightens saggy jawlines, but it plumps the lipophilic layers of your skin to contour and define the law within minutes. Using peptides and metallolactones together for the first time, it works quick and the results get better every day. No one else has this technology or our proprietary chemical-free base, so say goodbye to that double chin right now, and here's the best news. It is yours when you order Genucil for under-eye bag and puffiness, and for results in 12 hours, Genucil's immediate effects is also free. So text Drew1, D-R-W-1, to 77453, or go to Genucel.com, G-E-N-U-C-E-L.com. Imagine chin goes away, saggy jawline gone, 100% guaranteed your money back. Stop imagining. Order it now. Text Drew1, that's the number one, to 77453, or go to Genucel.com, G-E-N-U-C-E-L, G-E-N-U-C-E-L, Genucel.com. And again, your order is free when you order Genucel for under eye bags and puffiness. And for results in 12 hours, get Genucel's immediate effects, also free, Genucel.com. All right, CBD, it's everywhere today. And people have heard the reports that there's lots of anecdotal reports of significant benefit, but the science is not up with it yet. The bottom line is, although there are way more claims than clinical evidence right now, many people are using it and reporting great results. It's encouraging. I want to first define what we mean by CBD or cannabidiol. It's an extract from hemp. And while you might associate with marijuana, CBD is the non-rewarding, non-high-inducing component of hemp. It's what's responsible for the calming and relaxing effects in many people, not the high, so you don't get addicted to it. Now, about the products, there are a ton of them on the market. Forget the vast array of reported health benefits. It's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is clearly described so you can make an informed decision without all the promises that sound too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD are compelling. I'm pretty excited to see how things develop as science catches up with this booming industry. So if you're ready to try CBD, check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That is my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. And for a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with the code DRDREW. Again, the checkout code, Dr. Drew, for 25% off at Select CBD. Go to drdrew.com/select. One night, one goal. Stop suicide. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's Out of the Darkness Overnight Walk, the largest suicide prevention event in history. It's coming to San Francisco on June 8th, Boston June 22nd. Register today for the overnight and join thousands as we walk all night to raise funds and awareness for suicide prevention. People describe the overnight as one of the most powerful experiences of their lives, whether you're walking on your own or with an overnight team. Together, we will walk over 16 miles from dusk till dawn. You'll see the landmarks of San Francisco by moonlight, form lasting relationships, and raise millions for this important cause. Money raised supports the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Be part of something extraordinary. Register today at overnight.org or call 888-THE-OVERNIGHT. That's 888-843-6837. Again, you referenced Aristotle a couple times. If you throw back to Plato, Plato was very clear that that reptilian brain was the horses pulling the chariot, and the charioteer right. should be in charge. And the charioteer should just be thinking about things and telling the horses what to do, not appealing to the horses to, you know, give the horses sugar, and that's the only thing we have to deal with.
Right, but you have very little control over the horse, ultimately.
I know.
And, Jonathan Haidt has put this with riding the elephant, you know, the rider on the elephant, where the elephant is going to make the decisions. And we might think we can steer it in some ways, but there's other factors that play into that. So, you know, this idea of we can solve the problems about genetic engineering and vaccines and nuclear energy and climate and all these buttons, that we can do it just by piling on more facts is a failed construct.
Yeah, it is. And you mentioned there are four things. So nuclear energy, which is we now have fourth generation nuclear power plants that are safe, and we have ways to clean them up that are safe. And no one seems to be aware of that because no one, I guess, has done the persuasion. We have – what was the other topic? Oh, climate change.
Climate.
There's a lot we can do for that. We're not doing it. We're sitting around rather in a panic about it rather than doing something about it. What are your solutions for that?
Well, for climate?
Yeah.
Well, climate is an interesting one because the problem with climate is that too many of the people who are trying to talk about the realities go into this in an inflammatory way.
Yeah, they just want to panic. Be panicky.
Well, and if you go – you can't really talk – you can't convince people with a hockey stick. You know, it's too catastrophic. What you have to do is go in with the golf club model. And the way I did this with farm audiences is say, look at how many more growing weeks you have this year that you didn't have in 1950. And here are the new pests and pathogens that are here. And here's the reduction in chilling hours. You know, in Florida, we don't have peaches flowering because we're not getting enough chill hours.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers can see that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is connect them with that and say, here's how science is going to help you and what we're working on, because our job is to provide the farmers with the next generation of crops that will solve those problems. And it kind of has tacit understanding that there's a problem that we need to solve.
Mm-hmm. And that's in terms of creating plants that adjust to the climate change. How about correcting some of the CO2? Are you guys working on that? Because there's a greening of the planet too in response to all the CO2 and heat, right?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of discussion of being able to use plants to sequester carbon back into the earth.
Exactly. What about that?
Well, if you can get roots to grow deep and put that carbon back where it came from, that's great.
I mean, I don't understand why we don't look to the rainforest as an opportunity to do that.
Well, the problem is they're taking rainforests down to make more farming.
No, I get that.
And so what we need to be doing is intensifying our farming efforts on the land that's already there, leave the rainforests that are there, focus on that environmental initiative, and we can do that with genetic engineering because we can make each acre produce more.
See, that's why I doubt people actually want to solve the problem. When you say, I can take care of this, we can save the rainforest and deal with the CO2 problem, there's these genetically engineered plants we need to deploy. Oh, no. Well, what? do you want to solve the problem or not? We're going to have to solve this problem.
Well, that's what's so sad, though, is that these solutions, it's not like a pie-in-the-sky idea of someday maybe we can do this.
We could do it now. They are sitting, as opposed to sitting around panicking about it.
Well, the funny part is these solutions are sitting in refrigerators at UCLA. They're sitting in refrigerators up in Berkeley and in Davis. They're sitting in public institutions made with USDA and NSF money. Public paid for them. The solutions are there. They can't be deployed because of the high cost of deregulation and huge bar for testing and activists that will lay in front of that steamroller and make sure it doesn't move.
Right. So do we want to solve the CO2 problem or do we want to not solve that problem? If we want to get serious about solving that problem, we need to test this stuff, right?
Well, it for the most part has been tested in many ways for efficacy. But now the question is it safe to put out in the environment?
How is that tested?
EPA is very careful about that, to look at USDA looks at invasiveness, looks at its ability to displace native plants or native populations. EPA asks questions about, especially if it involves engineering with a plant pathogen, which some of the nuts and bolts that are involved in the process are derived from a plant pathogen. Then those have to be looked at very carefully for outcrossing and potential gene escape, that kind of thing. But generally, those assessments are all very clear and are done very well.
So what are the activists lying down on the tracks for?
Yeah, well, this goes back to where we started, really. They have this, and some people have even said they hate corporations more than they love people.
Yeah, it's like social justice warriors, that some of them really want to help people. Other ones just want to act out their malignant envy. We can't allow that to derail our world. Yeah. It's just beyond belief that we allow that.
Well, and this is the really sad part for folks like me that get involved in the communication side of this, is that we are a threat to them to the point where they target us. And what we have to put up with in terms of the harassment, which is daily, the folks that threaten our jobs and our positions, This is also where it goes, because we're starting to change hearts and minds, and you see more people getting involved in these conversations than ever before, and more scientists are getting involved, especially the younger ones, who see science communication as a great way to advance their career and actually kind of get out in front of the rest of a very crowded field of new PhDs who are looking for a very small number of faculty positions.
I just felt a little bit of hope just today when I heard that kid that went out to Congress to testify about himself being vaccinated. He looked at the facts and he realized his mother had become paranoid and had been convinced of something that was just simply just untrue, and he needed to get vaccinated. He did not want to be a threat to his community and also did not want to contract these illnesses, and he went and got the vaccines.
Yeah, that's the part that really resonates with me, is when I see a mother say, I have a newborn who I can't take out of the house right now in Oregon, in Portland area, because there's people with active measles walking around, and I can't risk my young child who has, you know, very cursory immunity that it's receiving from breast milk or from, you know, from the mother. And also, you know, the elderly, the immunocompromised. Yeah. There's by not vaccinating yourself, you're making yourself a threat to other people. And I don't know. I couldn't sleep at night like that.
His kid's name is Ethan Lindenberger. There are not enough vaccines around for me and my family. I as soon as they become – I take them. We take them all. As soon as the data looks good. The only vaccine I delayed on was the chickenpox. I took – in fact, I don't even think I gave that one to my kids, because there were some issues in Japan for a few minutes. And I was like, all right, let's wait and see on this one. But – HPV, you know, as soon as we can get that stuff, get into it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's preventing cancer. It's preventing cancer, for God's sakes. We have a shot that prevents cancer, and people don't want to take it.
The numbers play out on that, too.
Yeah.
I mean, they've actually demonstrated now in places where it hasn't been used. You've seen a huge dip in HPV.
Yep. And
or cervical cancer.
But now had neck cancer and anal cancer and penile cancer. Mm-hmm. These are all getting protected against. And guys like Michael Douglas are saying, yeah, I had the HPV, I didn't get the vaccine, now I've got head and neck cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a terrible cancer, and it's going up fast because people are not getting this vaccine. Now it'll presumably turn around finally. Safest vaccine profile of any vaccine in history, the HPV vaccine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so people just need to look. It's stunning to me that people, with all this information, I guess we just don't know how to evaluate what's out there. right? I mean, it's I even get angry at sometimes with medical students. They'll find some study that catches their attention. I'm like, no, you must understand all the literature in that area so you contextualize this one outlying study. Don't tell me that that outlying study is the truth. Put it in the context of everything else that's out there.
Oh, yeah. That is the ultimate. That's what we see all the time. You know, remember those three lumpy rats that occurred in the paper back in 2012? It was all over the media.
What was this now?
It was a test that came out of France where they said they fed GM corn and Roundup to rats.
Yeah.
And that the rats got cancer after 2 years and they looked horrible, like grotesque.
Yeah.
And they showed three lumpy rats. They didn't show the control rat, which is kind of funny because if you look on the table, it was just as bad. They used a kind of rat that called Sprague Dawley.
That gets cancer.
That gets cancer.
Yeah.
And so after 2 years, they were all—
They all got cancer.
They looked like tube socks full of ping pong balls.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, oh, look at what this corn did. The sad part is that that arrested deployment of GE crops in Kenya. It made other large policy decisions almost impossible for different governments who said, we now take this very seriously. Here we are 7 years later. That same group has never repeated or expanded that work, which is like, you know, when it's DOA, that means that something was seriously wrong. But then governments in Europe invested $15 million to have four different groups repeat that work, and all of them repeated it, didn't see it.
Right.
So here we are 7 years lost with deployment of crops that could have helped people because of a fear-based, what was a political move by a group of unscrupulous scientists.
So back to the tomato and its cost.
Ah.
This is sort of one of the things that Adam Smith also sort of marveled at, that he talked about the like Navy pea coat, I think is what he was describing, that somebody had to – you know, grow the sheep and shear the wool and then textile the wool and then create the buttons and then put the buttons on. But because everybody had their own specialized sort of spot rather than one person doing all of this, a affordable coat was able to be made. Is it the same thing with tomatoes?
It is amazing. When you work in the state of Florida or California in horticulture and in production and crops, you see what happens between the breeders that have to come up with the right genetics, planting acres and acres of plants to find the one plant that can do what it does. And that takes millions of dollars to get that step. And it's very expensive. I mean, imagine
is that supplemented in any way? Does the government get behind it? Or?
Sometimes a little bit, but most of these are self-sustaining breeding programs. So meaning if you come out with a really good strawberry, the university gets a little royalty money on every plant.
Got
that kind of keeps it going. Mm-hmm. But imagine citrus trees. You know, we're dealing with losing the citrus crop right now in Florida and to a disease. And you can't breed trees fast enough, you know, because it's 4 years before you can see a fruit if you push it.
Yeah.
But back to your tomato point about the cost of food, from the breeder to being able to put this thing into bulk up the seeds, plant this thing in a field, have the plants with irrigation, with fertilizer, protection from insects, protection from birds, protection from weather, having people stake them and tie them up. And these are all done by hand. And then harvesting those tomatoes once they reach the point where they're ready to be.
Is that by hand too?
That's by hand too.
And then transporting it.
And then so what you're looking at is this tremendous process with all these touch points and still you can't – like a couple of years ago, Florida farmers had to turn all their tomato farms into U-picks. Because
what's a U-pick?
Meaning just have the community come in and pick it yourself.
Wow.
Because the box to put them in cost more than the tomatoes were worth on the market because of floods of fruit that's coming in from Mexico, South America, other places. It really drives down the price for the American farmer.
Mm.
Our strawberry farmers are feeling that pinch right now. And so the cost of this is extremely low, and maybe we take it for granted a little too much.
We as a consumer?
As a consumer.
Oh, absolutely.
And so this is why some of the things we're really interested in at the University of Florida and other breeding programs around the country are interested in increasing the quality of fruits and vegetables with the idea that if we can come up with a tomato or a strawberry or a blueberry that tastes better than anything a customer has ever seen or consumer has ever seen, that now they'll kind of reignite their interest in fruits and vegetables, which also have great health benefits, and if we can eat that rather than junk food.
Mm-hmm.
And so our focus has really changed over the last decade away from just get more red things in the bucket to Let's produce something that the consumer will find extremely palatable.
Is there any concerns about the fruits and vegetables that come from elsewhere? I mean, they don't have the same regulatory constraints, I'm sure.
Well, they have to conform to our constraints. There were problems back in the 1990s where people and farmers in, say, Chile were using different insecticides and things that were being detected on produce coming here. But what we have right now is actually a system that's really good. But what comes in is very similar to what's here. It's just that they have much lower costs and different rules and different labor possibilities. And it's really nice to be able to fill our seasonal gaps. You know, it's nice to be able to go buy a peach, 365 days a year.
It's crazy.
I mean, when you were a kid, you know, we're not that different in age. I can remember, you know, hey, summer fruits.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Listen, I went to college in New England. And I remember when I would come home to Southern California, I'd want to stand in the produce section because it was so colorful and so different than what was getting, they were getting in New England. Everything was brown and small.
Yes. And this is what's happening in China. So much of changing in the consumers in China where they used to have – like friends of mine would say, we used to have cabbage. You know, that was what we had in most of the major cities in our grocery stores. Now they have tremendous variety. It's coming from New Zealand and Australia and then grown within China itself. Hmm. And, you know, and we're in the same boat over here. We have extreme availability of crops from all over the world that are all very safe, very nutritious, and we need to be eating more of them. But that said, we can do better. And our big efforts have not been in genetic engineering. They've been in traditional hybridization, just crossing two things, but doing so with direction that's based on the consumer's preferences. So at our university, we've had these massive consumer trials of thousands and thousands of tomatoes, well, hundreds of tomato varieties, to find the ones consumers like and then split them into their molecules and say, what are the molecules that are always present in a consumer-preferred tomato?
Oh, wow.
And this is work that's done by Dr. Harry Klee. He then would start to combine those tomatoes, these heirlooms that maybe you get a fruit or two per plant, right? They're mushy. They can't be grown commercially. But then combining those with the rock-hard commercial tomato, that thing that gives you the pink slices on your Subway sandwich, mixing it with the commercial tomato to make something that the consumer really likes.
Huh.
And I've actually brought some of those plants here.
Ooh.
And I don't know who, you know, if anybody here would like them, but I mean, hopefully somebody here would get excited about growing a couple tomato plants.
So, my wife probably would.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I bet she would.
These are,
Gary, you want to grow some tomatoes?
Down. Okay. finally have the yard to do it in.
That's what I'm saying.
There you go. These will be the best tomatoes you've ever tasted. These have been in trials all over the country, and they'll have 100 different tomatoes, all different heirlooms or whatever, and these always end up in the top five.
Do I have to use any insecticides or anything on it, or just grows itself?
Probably not. I mean, you do have to look at them. You'll get things like hornworms and other critters that'll live on them.
What's a hornworm?
it's a worm with horns, and it's ugly, and it eats tomatoes.
Nice.
But you can put a little powder on there, a little 7 powder or something. It'll get rid of it, or you know, others, you know, pick them off and throw them away. That was when I was in Africa. That you would say, well, how do you control the bugs on your plants? And they'll say, well, we just have the children come in and pick them off and take them away.
Wow.
So, I mean, it really makes you appreciate what we have with some very mild chemical controls that can solve these problems.
Is there an increasing enthusiasm for these scientific solutions? Is the headwinds reducing a little bit?
I think so. I think that people are getting more excited about novel flavors and colors. The millennials are great with this. And I think the consumer, as you start to, you know, have grocery stores that are maybe appealing to a higher end consumer with a little bit more enthusiasm for something novel, and maybe that's different from the other generations that liked it very straight down the middle and plain and predictable. Right now, we're excited about breeding for flavors and colors, looking at new opportunities that people get excited about. And at home, my wife and I, we have acreage where she farms. She's from Ukraine and grew up on a farm.
Hmm.
And so, you know, my hands are in dirt, you know, 7 days a week helping her out. But everything she grows is something that at the farmer's market, someone's going to go, wow, I've never seen that color before. I've never tasted that before.
Hmm.
I've never had, you know, this kind of thing before. And so people do get excited about novelty in their food. And that's really important.
Going back to scientific education, there's something that's been called the backfire effect that may or may not occur. What would you sort of, if you had like a primer you could give me and other people, what should, and you sort of hinted at it in terms of talking about your values and things, but I've been thinking about this for a while now because it's bothered me how difficult it is to get people to you know, to assimilate this, these important ideas. And I almost think you not only do you talk about your values, but also your worldview.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So give me a primer.
Well, that's so. When I tell people or I teach people how to respond to others, especially concerned consumers, it really is a two-step process. And the first step has to be listening. And this comes from a book called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. And he was a hostage negotiator that realized that changing the way you deal with a hostage situation, it couldn't be you making demands of that hostage taker, that you had to understand why they were there, that you had to listen to them and ask them good questions to make them feel that you had some empathy.
You heard them.
You heard them. You were sensitive to their situation. And there are ways that he would give you techniques to reinforce how you would be showing or demonstrating this listening and empathy. And things like, what do they call this? Oh, gosh, I'm totally blanking because intellectual charity. And this is where you make the other person's argument stronger.
Mm.
So in the case of genetic engineering, they'll say, well, it's all owned by Monsanto and we're afraid of them owning the food supply. And I'll say, well, you're probably also worried that it's covered in pesticides. You're probably also worried about monocultures. You know, you actually give them the arguments that you will later knock down.
Mm-hmm.
So Daniel Dennett always refers to the steel man argument. So not the straw man that's easy to knock down. You help construct the argument against yourself. And what that does is it shows the other person that you understand and that you're listening. It's not just that debate. You know, they have their point. You have your point. You beat each other over the head and walk away angry. You start out with this recognition and like this handshake, this intellectual handshake that says that you're listening. The second step is that sharing the values and saying, and I do this all the time. You know, I'm in science that I'm in because I care about the environment. I care about the food insecure. I want to feed the American consumer better stuff, and I want farmers to stay in business. Those are my four things. Farmers, consumers, the environment, and the food insecure. That's my platform. And when I say that, someone from Greenpeace might go, "Hey, man, me too." You know, and you're on the same page. And now we can sit and talk about the tools that I have in my toolbox as somebody who's worked in this for 32 years and say, here's how I want to solve this problem. And I'll listen to you about why you think it won't work. But at least let's put all the tools on the table to solve these important problems.
And now I normally get into what people often do to me. They'll go, oh, you got to read this book. Just read this book and it'll all make sense to you. So I will oblige them and read the book and realize it's just, you know, extremely biased and narrow and – But I don't know what to do. I can't come back and refute every chapter in the book. They won't sit through that.
You know? It's like the folks who used to debate evolution with Dwayne Gish, where he would just rattle off so many different things that you couldn't keep up with it and refute it. There's people who do that in genetic engineering too. But what you have to do in cases like this is just make that personal connection and realize that these are slow steps. And it's too easy to get angry and yell at somebody and say they're stupid, they don't get it. There's faculty in my university who used to do that. They said, if they don't get it, they're too stupid. You know, mm-hmm. Those folks aren't around anymore. But this is about, you know, if a student in my class didn't understand the assignment, I wouldn't say they're stupid and can't figure it out, too bad. I would say, come to my office hours. Let's talk about it. Show me what you don't understand. Let's start there. And so somehow when we get outside the classroom, we stop being professors and we really do need to do that better and realize that we are professors that are serving the public, not just the classroom. And when we step into these public discussions that we have to understand, we have to go in with softness and grace and be willing to listen. And then be willing to provide that information in the most effective way we can.
So that's the last step, which I also find hard because people don't understand biology.
Yeah.
So how do you get that across without even the context to communicate it?
And it's complicated biology, right? We're talking about DNA. We're talking about concepts that can even be misunderstood and scary. But what's so funny about this formula is that when you listen to somebody's concerns and you validate them, you say, I understand why you'd feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
If I read those websites, I'd feel that way too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, here's what's important to me. Then they don't want to know about the biology. I've established my credibility. I've established that we're on the same team. And they say, well, is it safe? I go, yeah, it's safe. Don't worry about it. You know, let's go have pizza. You know, I've had so many of those breakthroughs in my career, I get emails all the time from moms who say, you know, we had this brief conversation and now my kids can go to the birthday party and have hot dogs. You know, really sweet conversations with people who've changed their mind because I chose to engage them on Twitter or somewhere, you know, an email that I got out of the blue and took the time to answer it. And I answer them all. You know, I'm always, I don't let one go by. It's that kind of attention that really is what changes people. It's not the facts. It's the fact that somebody with credibility who understands this process cares. And I think that's the way you change it.
It's funny. In medicine, it doesn't work like that. It just doesn't. I was listening to somebody this morning. A guy was on the radio saying how his doctor had evaluated him and advised him and communicated and said, "Me too," and blah, blah. And he went, "No. It's a conspiracy. The drug companies just wanted my money. So I'm going to go to the web and listen to a bunch of people that know nothing."
That's right.
And I don't know what – I just kind of throw up my hands at that point. Huh. It's like you don't know.
Well, they know where they can go confirm their bias, right?
Yes.
They know they can. There's always somebody who will give you the information.
I mean, look at Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs had a treatable malignancy, mm-hmm. and he died of it because of this.
Yeah, no,
exact same phenomenon.
Yeah, there's a guy in Canada right now who is he's a science communicator who's taking all kinds of heat because he criticized a therapy where they're injecting people with vitamin C to cure cancer, cure in quotes. And this guy's getting all kinds of garbage. He's getting threats and all. And this is what scientists get for stepping into that. But back to what you're talking about, you know, when medicine is a little bit different than food, mm-hmm. because when we talk about food with people, that's going into that basal reptile part of the brain. Mm-hmm. Medicine appeals to that executive function. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, Kahneman's system two thinking. And so it's a little different. But people who have resistance to medical information, that's a whole nother creature. And I think that we can separate food and medicine in that way. That, you know, you can't appeal to their, if you can't appeal to them cognitively about medicine, because, you know, that's what I want, you know, tell me the facts.
Well, but they don't, the way I try to go at it is that you don't understand why you're even seeing a doctor. You're not going for his or her fund of knowledge. You're going for their judgment after seeing thousands and thousands and thousands of cases like yours. They've arrived at a judgment about what's right for you to have the best possible outcome. The information that doctor has goes without saying. They've had that all along the way. But what you're really going for is the judgment call for you. They can't get that. So because they're so used to information on the internet, they don't understand wisdom and experiential wisdom and all these other what Aristotle called phronesis.
Yes.
They like just facts or just information, which is just the beginning of understanding things like biology.
Oh, yeah. It's the integration, right?
Yeah.
And 10,000 repetitions.
Exactly.
And so this is where I get into this and I think about how I describe these things and how I work with these topics. Mm-hmm. I always like to think about all of the in trying to convince people or trying to turn people, going back to values, you know, what are the technologies that – and I'll ask them, what would you find is acceptable use of this technology? What would you think would be a good use? And the funny part is that they'll frequently say, well, if you could, you know, feed so-and-so or get over this problem. And you know what? It's already been done.
Right.
And so that maybe that's the easy way to
turn. So ask questions. That's a good way to do it.
Is asking questions.
Adam and I always laugh about it. He goes, I'm a carpenter. When I come in and tell someone how to hang a door, they don't argue with me about how to hang a door. And this is something infinitely more complex and something that, you know, you're really going for a judgment on. And they're going to argue with you about it. It's like, do you argue with your plumbers? Do you argue with your carpenters? And they're doing something much easier. Difficult, and also their experience comes to bear too. That's some of what you want. But oh my God, it really is something. Well, listen, Kevin, it has been a privilege. I'm so happy you came here, and I hope this was fun for you. I know you watched listen to the Adam and Dr. Drew show.
Yeah,
so
I've followed you guys since Loveline. I mean, it's so weird. I'm on a million podcasts, and I do a lot of media all the time, and I rarely get to sit with folks who I
who you listen to who you get to listen to.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
I've heard you on I forget where I picked you up. I listen to all kinds of crazy podcasts, and I think it was Rationally Speaking or
mm-hmm. It may be. Yeah, I do so many.
An Acquiring Minds one I do. Mm-hmm. I listen to all these crazy pods that my wife gives me grief about and teases me about, but I love them. And I think you were talking about some. This is sort of generally what you talk about, is it not?
Well, generally, yeah. I mean, we cover a lot of bases in biotechnology.
Anything else that's sort of on your mind these days?
Well, the thing that is what's coming, you know, the gene editing and the ways that we're able to do this with much more finesse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're going to see in the near future is whereas old school genetic engineering is putting a new book in the library,
mm-hmm.
this is erasing a letter or adding a new letter to a book.
Wow.
And doing so without leaving any other kind of hardware around.
Right.
And so this is where I think we're so exciting. It's so exciting. The people who have now been cured of HIV, which mm-hmm. is this last week, now targeting cells to remove that gene for future therapies.
Mm-hmm.
It may be very realistic that HIV is gone in the next few years because of genetic tweaks that we can do in
cells.
Oh,
I'm sure of that. That kind of thing is going to that's the future in medicine for sure.
In agriculture, the same thing. I mean, it's going to not be genetic engineering, not your grandma's genetic or grandfather's genetic.
What's the mechanism to be able to do that?
Well, it's this thing called CRISPR-Cas9.
Oh, yeah, CRISPR. Yeah,
so that whole thing.
Yeah.
But what it is, in common terms, is it's an enzyme that works like a molecular scissors. And you can give it guidance as to where to go to make a little cut and disrupt a gene. And so scientists can, with great precision, have it go into the 3 billion bases in a cell and make that one change. That's like being able to change 1 second in 100 years.
Yeah. Or like you said, change a letter in a book. That's crazy.
Or change a letter in a
Find
library.
Find that letter in a library. Yeah. Wow, it's true.
I always joke it with, especially with farm audiences, it's like removing not from the Ten Commandments. You know, it changes the entire thing completely in the opposite direction with one little tweak.
Be careful. That's what freaks people out.
I know.
They're going to see some monster Jack and the Beanstalk.
Or that I can covet my neighbor's goods.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
But that's how this technology would work.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so cool about this is that you can do it very inexpensively. Anyone can do it in their all of our laboratories do it right now. And it's the kind of thing where we'll have huge innovations that are going to come from this. I think that plus technology in the farm right now, robots are where it's at. You're seeing a lot of there's robots where I'm going tomorrow that walk the field and sniff for specific pathogens.
Oh, my God.
Or look for specific insects.
Crazy.
And when they find it, the drone flies in and applies a very specific insecticide to that spot.
Wow.
Or fungicide to that spot. So the precision and sensors and finally big data and computational science are coming to the farm. And I think that's going to revolutionize the way we do things too.
Fantastic. Again, the website is Talking Biotech Podcast at Kevin Folta, F-O-L-T-A. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Talking Biotech against the podcast. Anything else I need to hit?
No, it
Check sounds
him out
pretty
at
University
good.
Of Florida, where he is the professor and chairman of the Horticulture Sciences Department. Kevin, it's been a privilege.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks.
This is great.
See you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.